You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, find out why Wisconsin has one of the highest rates of binge drinking in the country and what that means for our health. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a cultural festival taking place this weekend.
The pandemic brought many annual festivals to a halt. This summer, some are finally making their comeback, like Greek Fest Plus in Madison. To celebrate its long-awaited return, we revisit this story from 2019, when Carol Griskovich talked with organizers from Assumption Greek Orthodox Church about the history of the festival.
It's my understanding that still, and I was digging into this, that we are the longest running ethnic festival in Madison. It's a Greek Fest Plus, because we want to really honor all of the diverse ethnicities in our community. But it's really a reunion, it's a block party, it's a community event, and especially last year, people would come up to me and say they've never felt more welcome at a festival in Madison as they have at Greek Fest.
For many years, this was the only Eastern Christian church in this part of Wisconsin. And so as a consequence, all the Orthodox people from all over the world who lived in central and southern Wisconsin came here to this church, and they still do.
Renato, Jason, happy birthday to your father.
Oh yeah, I didn't even say that.
Well, the church was started, it was incorporated with the state of Wisconsin in 1951, and it was a group of primarily Greek immigrants that relocated here in the Madison area that began the church.
My grandfather came at age 16 with some male relatives, and they began working on the railroad. They settled in Madison and opened up a restaurant, the Coney Island. First, it was located, I believe, on the 2nd block of State Street, and then later it moved to the 300 block of State Street.
Oh, should we just get like a variety pack?
Hi, can I have 4 baklava, please?
And we brought back this year the traditional Coney dog, Coney Island dog, which is how so many of the Greek immigrants made their living coming to America. And they brought with them the secret, the spices and the cumin and the cinnamon and to add to this puree sauce that gets spooned over a hot dog.
I'm gonna leave one spice out, just so no one knows. We've got cayenne, cloves, cinnamon, of course, oregano, of course, paprika, allspice, and a mystery spice. Garlic powder, onion powder, butter. Actually, butter is what caught me off guard with the recipe. It's like it's gonna give it a really kind of a thick richness. We're gonna cook it down so it's thick. We're going to puree it, so it's not chili sauce. This is Coney sauce. It's very specific to Greek immigrants.
Have you sampled the Coney sauce that we are using during Greek Fest? Because from what I have been told, we're using your father's recipe.
I have not, because I have never been fond. Isn't that terrible? Our bread and butter, and I was never fond of the chili sauce.
That's who we are as the church, who we are as Orthodox Christians. That familial bond that we already have through our worship is just transferred out into the celebration of our ethnic heritage and bringing of all of these people together. 2 days of this huge festival that just brings our excitement for one another out.
That was Georgiana Wilton, David Giffey, Patty Notes, and Father Michael Vanderhoof, who passed away in 2020. Music by Rikmos and Sergei Belkin. That story on Greek Fest Plus came to us from Carol Griskovich, who is also a member of Assumption Greek Orthodox Church. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Greek Fest Plus will take place in Madison September 9th and 10th. Now, Wisconsin is an outlier when it comes to alcohol, with higher rates of drinking and of binge drinking than the country as a whole. During the pandemic, alcohol-related deaths spiked here in Wisconsin, as they did around the country. But even before the pandemic, Wisconsin had a long-running upward trend in deaths caused by alcohol, almost tripling the rate from roughly 7 per 100,000 people in 1999 to 19 by 2020. Federal surveys have also consistently found that Wisconsinites are among the least likely to consider binge drinking a risky behavior. Our next guest joins us for a look at dangerous drinking, why it's such a problem in the state, and what it means for our health. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Wisconsin's drinking culture? Whether you've lived here all your life or you moved here from somewhere else, do you notice different attitudes toward drinking and toward binge drinking in Wisconsin compared to other places? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Maureen Buzalaki is the director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Maureen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's start with binge drinking. In 2019, about a third of Wisconsin adults reported binge drinking in the previous month, second highest in the nation after North Dakota at that time. Can you tell us more about that number and what we mean by binge drinking?
Sure. Binge drinking is 4 drinks in a 2-hour period for women and 5 drinks in a 2-hour period for men. And the reason why we say that is because then you're at 0.08. the legal limit. So I don't think folks necessarily understand, how alcohol affects them and how much. And excessive alcohol use not only includes binge drinking, mm-hmm. but also heavy drinking, which is considered 1 to 2 drinks a day, drinking while pregnant, and underage drinking. In terms of excessive alcohol use, every county in the state of Wisconsin has a higher rate of drinking than the national average. We're the only state where every county is above the national average.
Can you talk about some of the health consequences of our excessive drinking?
Yes, there's many. There's fully attributable deaths, including cardiomyopathy, liver disease, which I think a lot of us associate with fetal alcohol syndrome, and many others. And then there are acute deaths like alcohol poisoning, suicide, other kinds of injury-related deaths, with motor vehicle crashes, falls, suicide, homicide, firearms, aspiration, drowning, fire, hypothermia, and I could go on. And then chronic deaths associated with, partially attributable to alcohol, which is cancer for the mouth, throat, larynx, esophagus, larynx, breast, liver, and colon, heart disease, stroke, hypertension, pneumonia, and seizure disorders, to name a few.
I've had a lot of conversations over the years tackling the question, why Wisconsin? Why this focus on alcohol, particularly in Wisconsin? I've heard a lot of different answers floated and dismissed. What are some of your thoughts on that, Maureen?
Well, we have an interesting history. We weren't always like this. We had a number of leaders in the temperance movement. So we have kind of a varied history. In the last 20 years, we've seen Wisconsin policies change to allow alcohol in more and more places. In other places, it's not common to have alcohol in gas stations and certainly not cold or single serving, in gas stations. We find it at pretty much every event, it seems like. There's almost anything, even music festivals that are geared towards families and kids often will have alcohol with them. And then we are pretty liberal with our licensure. So we allow a lot of alcohol retail and bars and restaurants. And in other states, you've got like 1 alcohol license per 3,000 people in New Jersey or 1 to 1,500 in Idaho. In Wisconsin, the average is 1 for 354 people.
I want to get back to some of the consequences now, Maureen. And I think it may be hard to see this from within Wisconsin. When we stack up alcohol health consequences and compare them to the rest of the country, you mentioned that that county by county average, which is pretty striking. What are some of the other ways this shows up in Wisconsin's health consequences from alcohol being worse than the rest of the country?
So we have a very high number of liver transplants, you know, in comparison to other states, you know, based on our size. So that's certainly, and there's a number of healthcare consequences to the excessive alcohol use that we have in our state. So there's a number of injuries. We often think about motor vehicle injuries, but there's many others. We have very significant number of falls, you know, every year that are attributable to alcohol, you know, in the 500 range, which I think if you think about that, that's really high. And we lead the nation overall, as I understand it, in falls. You know, and so alcohol definitely contributes to that number.
We're talking about Wisconsin's drinking culture and the health consequences of our heavy drinking in the state. Maureen Buzalaki is with us, director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we'll look at possible policy alternatives. You could join in. What do you think could be done to address high rates of binge drinking in Wisconsin, heavy drinking overall? What support do people struggling with alcoholism need? What are barriers to getting help? Are there changes you'd like to see related to alcohol in your own community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Maureen Buzalaki, director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin, about why Wisconsin has among the highest rates of binge drinking in the nation, the health consequences of that, and what policy alternatives could be on the table. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think Wisconsin's culture affects alcohol consumption? Are there changes you'd like to see in state or maybe local law and regulations? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maureen, let's get into public policy now. Are there changes that, say, other states have made that have helped them move in a better direction that maybe we could learn from here in Wisconsin?
Yes, for sure. The State Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse released a report on excessive alcohol and what policies could be helpful, and they named 61 recommendations. And so they range from things that can be done in civic organizations, for example. You know, if there's an organization hosting a fundraiser of some sort, perhaps not serving alcohol or, you know, being very limited in how much alcohol is being served to send a message, right, in terms of the culture in the community. Looking at local government, there's a number of things they can do with alcohol licensing, you know, to make sure that we don't exceed how many licenses that we want in a population, you know, looking maybe at around schools and thinking about, you know, how much do we want people to see as they're walking to school? You know, so there's a number of different kinds of things that they can think about. Now, you have to be careful with licensing to make sure that you're being, you know, even-handed and handling every license the same. But there are definitely things that can be done, especially with festivals, for example, you know, and making sure that if there's alcohol served, that it is in, as you know, a separate area, that people are being checked for the ID, and again, that they're not over-serving the patrons.
I think a lot of times when we talk about alcohol abuse, we look at individual solutions, whether that's, you know, a character flaw in the person, or we need to focus more on treatment, and treatment is important, of course. Do you think we pay enough attention to bigger picture, community and policy stuff?
We have communities all over the state that are making a lot of changes and, you know, really looking at the alcohol environment. But I would say overall, I think there's a lot more that we could do on the local level in terms of making sure that we have, you know, an understanding of how much alcohol is costing a community, you know, and how, you know, really looking at some of the data from law enforcement in understanding how many of those calls for service are alcohol related. And I think when people understand some of the costs, that can be helpful. The same can be true with, you know, health systems and understanding that, and then making decisions on, you know, how dense do we want alcohol outlets? We know there's violence associated with clustering of retail outlets, you know, liquor stores and those kinds of places. So really thinking ahead about, you know, what is it that we want for our community, and making some of those kinds of changes.
Let's bring on a caller. Patty is with us in Hayward. Patty, hello.
Hi. I just had a comment. I just recently moved to Wisconsin, and I'm definitely seeing, I'm retired. I just am definitely seeing like the drinking culture. Well, a few years ago, I was at a festival that was trying to raise money for the program I was involved in, and they were going to be serving alcohol. So I reluctantly agreed, but I'm kind of glad I did it because we had to have some training. And the police officer told me, or told us, that the people that were getting the most DUIs that he was seeing were men that were going off to work in the morning because they had been drinking in the evening, kind of had a high tolerance to it, but still were testing higher. So anyway, that really struck me because I know several people like this. And so I started carrying a breathalyzer around with me. And I don't know, that has seemed to make a difference to people because a lot of these guys are just stunned by how high they still are.
So you, I'm sorry, Patty, you breathalyze your friends and acquaintances? Do they go for that?
Yeah, why not? Why not? You know what? Because my son-in-law got a DUI for going 45 in a 35-mile-an-hour zone. And my daughter's like, Mom, he seemed okay. He was great. I'm like, well, until you see the numbers, you think you're okay, you know? So some people are just barely over. I had one drink the other day, and I was already at a 0.05 because I'm very small. So, yeah, bring it with me. I offer it because I think that the stats speak louder than words.
Patty, thanks a lot for the call. Maureen, Patty sees the difference here in Wisconsin. She's working to do something about it all by herself. What do you think?
Well, I think that's an interesting approach for sure. I know some places, you know, have those breathalyzers, you know, and I think part of it is that people need to know what a serving size is. So they might think they're having one drink, but they're actually having two. Or if it's, you know, there are Elko Pops, there are, we call them kind of a binge drink in a can. So it can be a large can of White Claw or Four Loko, for example, and they can contain 2 to 4 to 5 even drinks. And so your blood alcohol level can get very high very quickly while you're drinking that. So really paying attention to what is a serving size and really looking at how many you're having. And you know, the CDC has a campaign, be your best, you know, drink less, be your best.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234, talking about Wisconsin's drinking culture and the health impacts of it, possible changes to fix it, with Maureen Buzlocki with the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Maureen, I mentioned briefly a treatment earlier for people who recognize, hey, I'm drinking too much, whether it's binge or chronic drinking. I don't seem to be able to fix this myself. Do we have treatment out there for them when they need it?
I mean, there is treatment in many parts of the state, but I can't say universally that it's easily available. It kind of depends on where you are. We now look at it as an alcohol use disorder and that there are, you know, kind of a spectrum of that. And so trying to think about, you know, yourself and how you are with drinking and, you know, are you not having the relationship you want, might be a good idea to talk to a healthcare provider. The CDC website also has, you know, kind of a quick quiz to help you also think about that, because it's, you know, sometimes it's not that you have an alcohol use disorder, but that you're, you know, frequently binge drinking, and, you know, you can get into a lot of trouble with that. And so it's important to try to work on that early. So if you think you're having, you know, an issue, you should probably talk to somebody very quickly. And I would always recommend healthcare as a first step.
In just our last minute or so, Maureen, back in the day, I talked to you when you were with Smoke-Free Wisconsin. We've seen the number of smokers in the U.S. Drop by about half for over a 16-year or so period. Are there lessons from public health smoking campaigns that you think could apply to alcohol?
I do. I think there's a combination of really building public awareness, having strong policy, and really having kind of that cross sector where you're working with public health, you're working with health systems, you know, law enforcement, Department of Transportation, and others.
Maureen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Been talking to Maureen Buzalaki, director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She talked to us today about Wisconsin's high rates of binge drinking and other alcohol problems, the health consequences, possible policy solutions. Still time for you to share your story, your thoughts on this issue. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new report weighs the huge cost of invasive species around the world. Look at the massive price tag and check out invasive species here in the state. Our guest is a researcher who's focused on one particular species. We'll dig into that as well. And Ozempic and some of these other big name drugs are starting to change the way we talk and think about weight loss. A Wisconsin expert on weight management joins the show to look at the roles of hormones, metabolism, these medications, and a whole lot more in determining our weight. You can get started right now with your experiences. Have you tried or thought about trying one of these new weight loss medications? Love to hear your story. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation, that and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a documentary filmmaker and medical expert answer questions about a common but often overlooked and underdiagnosed disease, endometriosis. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Endometriosis is a gynecological disease that affects about 10% of women and teen girls around the world. For many people dealing with the condition, it can be painful, disruptive, and debilitating. But despite being relatively common, it often takes endometriosis patients as long as 6 to 10 years to get a diagnosis, sometimes longer still to find treatment options that work. A new documentary called Below the Belt shares the stories of four women whose lives have been disrupted by endometriosis and who are seeking effective treatment. Here's one of them, Jenna, a registered nurse in Los Angeles, who was interviewed for the documentary.
For years now, I've been sent to every specialist that makes sense based on my symptoms, OBGYNs, pulmonologists, cardiologists. They don't see a problem based on their specialty. No one's looking at the big picture. And so now, what am I supposed to do to get better?
I thought that maybe I'm dying or I have some kind of rare disease. But then I go online and find that millions of women are going through exactly what I'm going through.
The first time that I was told it could be endometriosis, I'd never even heard of it.
Our next guests say that more funding and research is needed to get better diagnosis and treatment of the condition. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or a loved one have endometriosis? Has it been tough to get a diagnosis, to find care and treatment? What questions do you have about the disease? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Shannon Cohn is a documentary producer and director. Her new PBS film, Below the Belt, follows the stories of four women diagnosed with endometriosis. Shannon, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And Dr. Camille Ladani is director of the Minimally Invasive Gynecological Surgery Section for the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, who specializes in endometriosis and chronic pelvic pain. Dr. Ladani, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Ladani, can you start us off with a basic definition of endometriosis and what it looks like for women suffering from it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a general diagnosis is when you have the presence of viable and estrogen-sensitive endometrial-like cells that are found outside of the uterus. Once they're there, they can implant into various tissues, they can grow, and they can cause a very widespread inflammatory response. People present with very different symptoms and degree of symptoms, but a large proportion of patients will present with pain. Some people have infertility, some will have abnormal bleeding patterns, some will have various gastrointestinal symptoms, and others will have fatigue, as well as mental health symptoms such as depression and anxiety.
And Shannon, in Below the Belt, you share four other people's stories. This is also, I understand, your story. Can you talk a little bit about your own experience with endometriosis and trying to get it diagnosed?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, Below the Belt and our previous film, Into What, comes from a very personal place. I do have endometriosis. I first had symptoms at 16, yet I didn't hear the word endometriosis until 13 years later. So 13 years of really chasing symptoms and meeting with different specialists and my pediatrician and primary care provider, my school nurse, using their best efforts, really trying to help me find answers, but no one knew really what was, you know, going on. No one put the pieces together. So, and Below the Belt in particular came, you know, the impetus behind it came after I was very fortunate, I have two young daughters, and yet they have a 7 times increased risk. There is a 7 times increased genetic risk among sisters and between mothers and daughters. And when I learned this, I decided that, you know, let's use film. Let's use film as a means to change this.
Dr. Ladani, what are some of the obstacles that lead to patients having, in some cases, years to get a diagnosis?
Absolutely. I think initially patients are told by various people that perhaps their symptoms are normal, that it's just something that they have to accept and just bear through. I think it can also be challenging to talk about some of the very personal symptoms that they encounter. And so finding providers that they can really trust, that will really listen to them and help them to feel heard. And then I think once they do present, because patients with endometriosis present in so many different ways with symptoms that can overlap with other conditions, oftentimes providers don't realize. We now have society guidelines that tell us that even though we need surgery as the gold standard for diagnosis, we don't need that to begin treatment and to move forward with that presumed diagnosis to try to start, you know, treating those symptoms.
Shannon, in Below the Belt, we heard there Jenna talking about feeling shocked that she had never heard of endometriosis, even as a nurse herself. Can you talk about the obstacles people faced, the people in your documentary and others face in trying to navigate the system and get that diagnosis, even when they have a lot of medical training themselves?
Absolutely. I mean, and Dr. Ladani hits the nail on the head. There are so many obstacles. I say, you know, endometriosis is a perfect awful storm of so many things. It's about, you know, menstrual taboo and societal taboo of talking about below the belt, you know, issues in women. It's about gender bias. It's about racial bias. It's about institutional and financial barriers to care. And these are all issues I think that everyone can identify with. It's something that we all struggle with. What does it mean if we're relegated to subpar treatments because we can't, you know, we don't have the financial resources to seek, you know, the best care, quote unquote, and that's things that the film, you know, investigates.
We are talking about endometriosis, a new documentary out from filmmaker Shannon Cohn. With us, also with us, Dr. Camille Ladani from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Ladani, I learned in the documentary and from reading up on some of your work, the preferred treatments for endometriosis have changed, it seems like, quite a bit over the years. What did we used to do? What is our first line best treatment right now?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think, unfortunately, we haven't made nearly as much progress as we would like. And so we are unable to really, truly individualize care as much as we would like to as providers. So when we think about that presumed diagnosis where we start treating people, we still utilize hormonal suppression a lot. We still believe that endometriosis responds to the hormones that our body produces naturally. So we do still use hormonal suppression, but I think that what's really important is evaluating the whole patient, you know, thinking about the symptoms that they have at that time and what are their goals at that time in their life, and trying to tailor how we approach those symptoms and not just necessarily only use hormonal suppression. So we want to think about other chronic overlapping pain conditions. We really want to be collaborating, because if they have GI symptoms, can we garner help from our GI professionals? Are we utilizing pain psychology? Are we utilizing pelvic floor physical therapy? Are we utilizing surgery when it's time to do so? You know, are our patients trying to plan for a family? So it's just very, very important that we're communicating with what their goals are and then tailoring those treatments at that time, whether it's medical management versus surgical management.
And Shannon, one of those treatments Dr. Ladani just mentioned ends up being a part of the story for I think all of the women you follow, trying to get a particular kind of effective endometrial surgery, and then finding that their insurance does not cover that. Can you talk about the financial hit these women were taking?
Absolutely. I mean, like Dr. Ladani says, you know, it's really such an individual disease, and the treatment protocols vary widely. But yes, in the film, there a subject that does try to access a type of surgery called excision surgery, which is by many considered the gold treatment, which is where excision or lesions of endometriosis are excised or removed from the body. The issue is that many providers who perform this type of surgery operate out of network. So if a patient would like this type of surgery and picks a provider that is in private practice, for example, a lot of times they have to pay out of pocket. And unfortunately, that's a financial barrier for too many. And, you know, they're using credit cards. They're using savings to access this type of surgery, which is evidence of, you know, a larger problem, a larger broken system that we all, I think, can identify with.
That's Shannon Cohn, documentary producer and director of the new film Below the Belt. Also with us, Dr. Camille Ladani, director of the Minimally Invasive Gynecologic Surgery Section at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking about endometriosis, a gynecological disease affecting about 1 in 10 women and girls around the world, why it can be tough to get a diagnosis and get effective care. Coming up, we'll look at research, how much investment we have and haven't made on endometriosis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you, about your life? If you've been dealing with endometriosis, what have your experiences been like navigating the medical system to get a diagnosis, to get some kind of treatment? Have you joined support groups on social media? What has helped you? Join in with your experiences, your questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about endometriosis, the diagnosis and care of endometriosis, with Dr. Camille Ladani from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and filmmaker Shannon Cohn, director of a new PBS documentary about endometriosis called Below the Belt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've dealt with endometriosis in your life or that of a loved one, and you're willing to share the story, if you're willing to talk about it with us, we would love to hear from you. Where did you find out about it? Have you looked on social media and gotten some inspiration on avenues to pursue? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Shannon, part of the goal of your documentary, it seems like, is to get people talking about endometriosis. You point out in the film that, you know, we're not even willing to talk about periods and menstruation, much less a condition like endometriosis. Are you seeing that change, though?
Absolutely. I do. I have such great, like, you know, hope with our new generations, really breaking the taboo around, you know, talking about menstrual health and periods. And I, you know, like I said, I have two young daughters, one's 15, and I maybe it's because I'm her mother, but at the same time, like, she will talk with her friends about her period. Like, she talks about what she's going to have for lunch. So she'll probably be mortified that I'm sharing that, but maybe not, you know, maybe not, but because I just see, you know, the tide, so to speak, is changing, and thank goodness.
Dr. Ladani, part of the documentary talks about research funding for endometriosis compared to other common conditions. It seems like there's not a lot. What would you hope to see when it comes to research priorities?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. It's so challenging. I mean, what we see right now is a lot of really small projects. And unfortunately, when we have these smaller projects, it's hard to combine those efforts. And so I think that coming together, we work a lot on like multi-institutional projects, trying to get larger numbers of people involved because, you know, I agree with Shannon, patients are so interested in talking about this. I mean, my patients tell me all the time, if you have a project, I will do it. Just tell me where and when to be. So it's just a matter of trying to continue the efforts, helping people to understand how important this is and how much it's impacting the quality of their life, because there's just so much bias, especially when it comes to pain. And so it's easy for some of these people to just really be disregarded. But I think that if we can get more numbers, then we can start to get more information so that we can really start to individualize care in a meaningful way.
And Shannon, that's one kind of success story in your documentary, an effort to get more funding from Congress for endometriosis. Now, one of your patients, one of the patients you follow, goes to Washington and testifies. She has kind of an inside connection. Her grandpa was the late Senator Orrin Hatch. Good news, I guess, more funding, but bad news, that's what it takes? Like, somebody has to be that personally affected to put this before the Senate?
Right. Well, you know, unfortunately, that seems to be, you know, to be the way a lot of things work, you know, and I think a lot of listeners probably won't be surprised by that. But, you know, at the same time, you know, when something becomes personal for anyone, I mean, it's a human experience. We obviously care about the people we love, and when they're negatively affected, we're, of course, going to care about the larger issue at play. And that's what happened with Senator Hatch. He saw his granddaughter suffer immensely and said, okay, I see the human toll of this disease. Let's do something about it. And fortunately, he knew that that would take a bipartisan effort. He reached out to Senator Elizabeth Warren, who obviously is a Democrat senator from Massachusetts, and really has helped us, you know, put together this really great bipartisan coalition of partners on Capitol Hill to say, hey, you know what, we all care about women's health, we care about this condition and how it affects not only on a personal but also societal level, and it's time to do something about it.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Melanie is with us in La Crosse. Melanie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Melanie?
Well, about 30 years ago, I had endometriosis pretty severely, and my lung collapsed. And so I was hospitalized for 9 days and had my lung lining removed. And it was because endometriosis had perforated my diaphragm and entered my lung. It's quite unusual.
Melanie, well, I'm glad you're here to tell us about that. That sounds very serious. Thank you so much for sharing that. Dr. Ladani, now I know endometriosis, as I understand it, mostly is affecting things in the area of the uterus, but it can spread to other organs. It sounds like that happened to Melanie. How common is that?
Yeah, it's certainly, I mean, thankfully, and I'm so sorry you went through that. You know, thankfully, it's not as common for it to progress like that, but absolutely can. And so I think that as providers, it's so important for us to really think about these symptoms. You know, we tend to focus on one body area, but we have to pay attention to what else is going on. And, you know I try to really pay attention to, do people have symptoms that are cyclic? Do they respond, you know, kind of in a monthly pattern in a similar way that other more traditional menstrual cycle symptoms might happen? And really pay attention to that and really work with other providers and other specialties to identify these more rare and potentially very dangerous situations.
Melanie, thanks again for sharing that experience. And Shannon, that strikes me as another goal of your documentary, to get that diagnosis earlier so that we don't have extreme cases like Melanie where something could actually start damaging other organs.
Absolutely. I mean, a couple of the different initiatives we have going with the film, of course, is first widespread awareness, which is one reason that it's, you know, premiering on PBS. And we're doing an international rollout over the next coming months so that, you know, everybody understands about endometriosis. But a second aspect is really working with frontline providers, those people in position, school nurses, pediatricians, primary care providers, ER providers, so that when people go into these settings and share these symptoms, right away, these providers think, oh, right, this could be endometriosis. And girls, you know, hear the word at 13 instead of 23 or 33.
Dr. Ladani, obviously endometriosis is on your radar. What are you hoping to see when it comes to what Shannon was just talking about, getting the word out to other medical care providers to hopefully spot this a little earlier?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that comes into just goals of community efforts with education to patients and families and providers. My goal is to see more, you know, more cohesive collaboration, because I think that unfortunately in our training, we know each of our specific individual areas. I myself, you know, don't know as much, of course, about the, you know, the pulmonary system. And so unfortunately, patients end up just getting bounced around from provider to provider, which is just not a very cohesive way to care for these folks. And so what I would love to see is just more collaboration, even within my personal system here, so that we can more efficiently take care of these patients.
Shannon, something I don't want to miss from the documentary Below the Belt is, you know, endometriosis will look a little different from one person to another, but for the people you follow, in many cases, this is really debilitating and life-changing. Can you talk about some of the experiences you saw from the women you worked with?
Absolutely. I mean, we really thought it was important to show a wide variety of experiences with ages, races, socioeconomic statuses, so that people understand that endometriosis can affect everyone in a different way. And just quickly, everyone who's listening right now is actually affected by endometriosis, whether they realize it or not, either directly or indirectly. It's just a fact. It's just so pervasive. But with the four characters, the four subjects in the film, you know, one is affected. She doesn't really have symptoms as much, but then her fertility is compromised. And she was told early in her 20s, you know, she will never have children. So really going on that journey with her to see what that means. What does that mean when you, you know, are told something like that at such a young age? And for other, like Jenna, who you mentioned earlier, who's a healthcare provider herself and never heard of it, gone to the ER many times with symptoms, yet she never hears the word. And I will say that something we go into that I think is something to note is she is a woman of color, is a registered nurse, and she felt compelled to bring her partner, who's male, who is actually a software programmer, into the doctor's appointments for her because she recognized that she was taken more seriously when he was in the room, and almost to the point where she would always let him speak for her. And so what does that say when someone obviously so educated, so capable, is letting a partner speak for her on a condition that's happening to her body?
Dr. Ladani, can you share some advice for someone who's listening thinking maybe I have endometriosis? What kind of information, what kind of preparation might they have to come into that first appointment with a doctor or maybe that appointment with a specialist?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I always tell my patients that, you know, any time that they're willing to create a diary of symptoms to help identify any patterns, timing, associations, anything like that, so that they have that information there with them. I think it can be very emotional, you know, when they're trying to garner all of this energy to think of everything that they can in this very long journey. So doing some of that work ahead of time so that they can really just feel heard during that visit is important. I always tell people to remember that this is a process. You know, unfortunately, since we cannot cure this disease, it's often not straightforward and it will change over time. And so I tell them, just remember that, you know, any given time, it can change, it can get better. You know, what they're feeling does not have to be forever, and that we can continue to work together to make these changes. And so just to advocate for themselves, you know, to work together with their provider.
And we'll leave it there. Dr. Ladani, thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for doing this.
And Shannon, thanks for sharing your documentary with us.
Of course. Thank you. It's been an honor.
Been talking to Shannon Cohn, documentary producer and director of the PBS Below the Belt that we've been talking about. It's about endometriosis, and Dr. Camille Ladani, director of the Minimally Invasive Gynecologic Surgery Section at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. They join us for a closer look at endometriosis, an often painful and debilitating disease that affects an estimated 10% of women and teen girls worldwide. Difficult to get a diagnosis in a timely fashion, too. Still time for you to share your story, if you're willing, on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.